Thank you very much, Alain, and thank you for inviting me to this interesting symposium. I know Alain since the early 1980s when we did some work together, and that was great fun. I will talk today about our efforts to use dopamine neuroblasts for dopamine neuron replacement in Parkinson's disease. This is something that's been going on now for almost 30 years. It was in 1987 that the first patients were transplanted in Lund using tissue material that was obtained from aborted fetuses in the age of 6 to 9 weeks. In these patients, we've had to pool tissue from several fetuses in order to get enough. Some of these, the total of 18 patients have been transplanted in Lund under the leadership of Olle Lindvall, the neurologist and a close friend of mine. Some of these patients have been followed up to 18 years clinically, monitoring the changes in the patients. And from four of the patients, the brains have come to autopsy and been analyzed at between 12 and up to 24 years after transplantation. So what's the overall outcome of this approach? Well, it's very valuable, I can say, from the start. In literature, the over 300 patients have been reported, but many of those have not been followed up properly and properly reported. Roger Barker in Cambridge made an effort a few years ago to collect data from four centers that have been more leading this development, and came up with 65 grafted patients that, and this is the outcome. You can see if you use 30% reduction in the UPDRS scale as the cutoff for clinically meaningful improvement, one ends up with 40% of the patients showing this degree of improvement. The other 60%, they show little change, and some continue to decline. Now, there is one patient that is sticking out and is quite remarkable, and it's this one here that has been was monitored by Olle Lindvall up to 10 years after transplantation, and he was the fourth patient operated in Lund in 1989, and last year he died and the brain came to autopsy, and you see here Olle and Stig, the neurosurgeon, in an intense discussion with Yayi, who is Patrick Brundin's close ally, who is in charge of doing the analysis of the brains. So this brain was collected 24 years after transplantation. And this patient is one of the perhaps most carefully studied ones in this series of 65, and it's been followed. And he's interesting because he's the only one that has remained with a single unilateral transplant. Initially, there were five patients in early on that were given transplantation only on one side, and this was for safety reasons. One wanted to see that this didn't cause any problem. Then they were offered to get a second transplant, and four of the five got that. But this one, patient four, he felt he was good enough and didn't want to have a second one. He was 50 years old when he got the disease in 1980. 9 years later, he had developed on-off fluctuations and were then included by Olle in the transplantation program. And over the first 3 years, he showed a gradual clinical improvement, and up to the point that he could stop L-DOPA medication. And when Olle assessed him 10 years after grafting, he had sustained or continuous clinical benefit, no rigidity, minor hypokinesia, no on-off fluctuations. And then he died in 2013. He was 83 years old then. And at that point, he developed dementia, and the pathologist says it's PDD, Parkinson's disease with dementia, with abundant alpha-synuclein pathology throughout cortex. So he's one of these cases showing that even if you repair the dopamine system, the underlying disease is, of course, progressing, and the alpha-synuclein pathology will develop. He's been well studied, and he's been the subject of two publications, one in 92, together with patient three, followed over 3 years. And then again, 10 years after his surgery, he was analyzed again using more refined PET imaging that I'm going to talk about. So the interesting point is that he has this transplant on one side. So the other side can be seen as a reference, a kind of control. And what you see if you, this is fluorodopa imaging, which is a very useful way to monitor dopamine production in the striatum over time. And it's done repeatedly. Here you see three scans. Here at pre-op, he has much reduced fluorodopa signal, particularly in the putamen. And then on the transplanted side, there is a gradual growing up of a new signal in the putamen. All the tissue was put in the putamen. And you can see here that the non-grafted putamen is declining, reflecting the continued degeneration of the dopamine system. And there is then the reverse development of the signal on the grafted side. So by 3 years, he's up into the normal range. So in his case, the transplant was able to restore dopamine production to normal levels. And this is now the 10-year assessment that Ulla did together with Paolo Piccini in London. And here you can see two changes that are significant. One is the fact that his on-off fluctuations, or time in off, which was most of the day before surgery, totally disappeared after, here it's at the 4-year time point. You can see that it happens gradually. It takes at least 2 years here and 4 years there. Jupiter S is also declining gradually and stabilized around 50% of pre-value and maintained over time. And here is the fluorodopa uptake. Over 10 years, you can see that there is a continued loss on the non-grafted side, whereas the grafted side is leveling off here around 4 years and then remaining. he stopped L-DOPA medication here around 3 years, and sometime around that time, immunosuppression was also removed. So what about the pathology then? So his brain came to autopsy and was stained for TH, and his transplant is really remarkable. Here is the a normal non-age-matched patient, or a non-Parkinsonian age-matched patient, I should say, with the TH-positive staining throughout putamen. And here is the control site, which interestingly seemed to lack completely TH positive terminals. I'll show a high power soon. And then you have the two of the graft sites here, the caudal and the rostral, and with the large numbers of dopamine neurons and a TH innervation that fills out the entire putamen. And interestingly, as in animal studies, it respects the boundaries of the dopamine innervated territory. So globus pallidus, that's sitting here, the pallidus putamen border is quite clearly marked. So the axons will grow up to the border, but not extend beyond. And the same thing with the corpus callosum here and the thalamic radiations on the medial side. Terminal density, this is now with dog field, revealing what's left on the control side. You can see that there are hardly any axonal ramifications left. What's left are these pre-terminal axons that end bluntly without ramification, and they are quite few and scattered. On the transplant side, you see the terminal innervation, and perhaps you can appreciate that there are lots of terminal varicosities that is very much like what's seen normally. Bengt Mattsson, my colleague in the lab, has done actual fiber counting using a very special technique that allows counting exactly the axon terminal numbers. And you can see he's measured at different levels from the graft medially and laterally from the graft core. And medially, close to the graft, the innervation density is close to what's seen in this single age-match control that we have access to, and then dropping off. And then on the lateral side, it's somewhat less density, but still up to about 50% of normal on that side. So these four fetuses, or the cells that we could obtain from four fetuses, is sufficient to produce a complete reinnervation of the putamen. One interesting possibility with the unilateral design here is that one can look at dopamine release with the racloprid displacement binding technique that's developed for PET. This technique makes use of two things. One is racloprid binding that competes with the endogenous dopamine release. So the amount of binding to the receptors will be inversely correlated to the amount of dopamine released in the synapse. And to show this, the patient is given a single dose of amphetamine, which gives a pulse release of dopamine, and that's displacing the racloprid. So this is what it looks like in a normal individual. You see racloprid binding here bilaterally, no asymmetry. And then when amphetamine is given as a pulse, it displaces the binding, and you can see this reduction. And it's the reduction is about 30% or 30-35% of the baseline binding. In patient four, there are two interesting observations. One is that there is now an asymmetry in the baseline binding, so that the non-transplanted side has a higher binding capacity than the transplanted side, suggesting that there is a baseline dopamine release from the transplants that is absent in the denervated putamen. And then on amphetamine pulse, on the transplanted side, there is a marked reduction in binding, suggesting that the innervation is dopamine releasing, whereas on the non-grafted side, the binding is unaffected. So this gives an idea that the neurons are fully capable of baseline release and also evoked release in response to amphetamine. So all in all, I think our conclusion from various observations is that this kind of cell therapy can be made to work. It can restore motor functions up to clinically significant levels, and that this can be sustained over decades in the grafted patients. But there are problems with this approach. The results, as you saw, is far too variable to be acceptable. And the use of primary fetal tissue is both practically and ethically problematic. It's definitely difficult to standardize. There is a risk for contamination, and there's a challenge, constant challenge, to get enough cells for transplantation. So clearly there is a need to generate cells specifically from transplantation, and this has now been ongoing for a long time. The most interesting work in and most promising work, I should say, is the one using pluripotent stem cells, either embryonic stem cells or iPS cells. And this has been ongoing for about 15 years and gradually developed. The two alternative approaches that are mostly pursued is either the one that Ron Mackay and his colleagues developed initially, using an embryoid body protocol with a neural induction step followed by an expansion and differentiation step to generate dopamine neuroblasts. And then this mix is then transplanted. The alternative is to do a neural induction and generate neural cells that are expanded and differentiated. And this has been pursued in parallel. The real, the most important development recently has come from the insights that Thomas alluded to in his talk, that the dopamine neurons are generated from the midbrain floor plate cells. These cells that express LMX1A and FOXA2, these are the genuine precursors. And this has been utilized in two protocols that now produce cells that are very interesting. One is from Lawrence Studer's lab, published in 2011, and one from our own center, from Marlene Pommer and her colleagues, that was published a year ago, building on the basic principles of Studer's protocol. So the main features of these protocols is to monitor the production of this cell that is expressing both FOXA2 and LMX1A. And this is achieved by a combination of the classic factors, Sonic Hedgehog and F8, plus an induced Wnt signaling step using a GSK inhibitor. In this way, one can get large numbers of cells with these features, and they can then be expanded as precursors and then turned into or differentiated further into dopamine neuroblasts. And in contrast to many other protocols using human cells, these cells actually survive after transplantation. It's been a problem earlier with human cells that either the cells didn't survive or you got overgrowing tumor generating transplants. But these ones now, they are transplantable, as it's called. So here is what Studer and his colleagues reported in 2011 with this protocol. They got, this is the column of injected cells into the stratum with large numbers of Th-positive cells. And when checking for FOXA2, there is an addition cells with a precursive nature that remain. What is not so evident here is fibril growth, which is largely due to the fact that the survival time here is relatively short. These cells are functional. This is the analysis performed in the Studer paper, where you can see that over about 4 months, there is a gradual improvement in both the amphetamine rotation test, as well as in two non-drug tests, this stepping and cylinder test. But again, the improvement occurs beyond 3 months. And that's the time when the cells have matured to the point that they start to grow out axons and provide an axon innervation of the target. And here is from Marlene Palmer's study, where they used amphetamine rotation test, and you can see that the time course is very similar, starting around 12 weeks. And they also measured dopamine release in vivo using the amperometry technique, and could show that around 4 months, there was a significant baseline dopamine release. So the questions that are being addressed now is, how good are these cells actually? How good are they compared to the reference cells, the fetal dopamine neurons that we know survive and grow and function well in the brain? And to what extent are these cells integrated into brain circuitry, which is an interesting feature that would increase their functionality if it happens. The first thing to be analyzed is the fiber outgrowth. As I said in the studio paper, they didn't follow that long enough. These are 6 months transplants, and by 6 months after transplantation, this is now in rats, 600 oxydopamine lesion rats. And what I'm going to show has either been done in cyclosporine-treated animals, which is an immune suppression, or in nude rats, where one doesn't have to use immune suppression. What is apparent is, first, the fiber outgrowth is very good, and that's in contrast to many of the earlier studies where the maturation of the cells were not good enough to provide any significant innervation. And secondly, one can see innervation of both the classical nigral targets, that's the dorsal striatum, but also the key VTA targets, or A10 neuron targets, in the nucleus accumbens, in the anteromedial frontal cortex, and this is the limbic cortex. And we see also innervation in areas like amygdala and septum, which are A10 innervated. The functionality of the cells have been looked at with the D2 receptor binding. Instead of raclopride, Philippe Pantry here in Paris has used another ligand called falipride, which is doing the same thing as raclopride. And you can see that in the unilaterally denervated animals, there is a higher binding of this D2 ligand on the denervated side, like we saw in the patient 4. And in the transplanted animals, this is now reversed, so that the signal now is, the excessive signal is normalized. And on amphetamine pulse, there is the expected down regulation of raclopride binding. This is correlated here with DAT binding PET, using a DAT ligand on the grafted side. In cellular analysis, one can see both kinds of neurons present in the graft, the A10 Nigel type neurons and the A9 Nigel type neurons and the A10 VTA type neurons, with the characteristic markers, the calbinin and GERK2 markers. So both on types of innervation as well as on cellular morphology and phenotype, this indicates that both major subtypes are being formed. We've also studied the functional potency of the cells. This has been very much discussed in earlier stem cell publications. The fact that one can generate protocols with many thousands of dopamine of TH positive neurons, but the functional impact is much less than the estimated cell number, suggesting that in many protocols only a small subfraction of the TH positive neurons are actually contributing to function, which would be the same as to saying that only a fraction of them are mature enough to generate functional reinnervation of the target. With these cells, we did an incomplete differentiation step to generate low numbers of TH-positive cells. And they were grafted and compared in number to what's been studied with human fetal cells. The threshold for a functional effect measured by the amphetamine rotation test as an assay is around 600-700 neurons. That's the what is required to induce an effect. In this experiment, we see that we can get a complete reversal of this defect by somewhere around 1,000 cells. And there are two animals in this group with 500 neurons that have complete reversal. So we think that in this protocol, virtually all of the TH-positive neurons are contributing to function. And what about outgrowth? Well, to assay this in a more interesting way, we did transplantation into the substantia nigra. This goes back in time. Years back, we found that if we transplanted fetal ventral mesencephalic neurons from humans into rat substantia nigra in 6-hydroxylation animals, these neurons were capable of growing axons rostrally along the nigrostriate pathway and the medial foramen bundle to innervate rostral targets. And we repeated this using here a human NCAM staining antibody that's specific for human NCAM. And you can see the graft here, and you can see also the innervation pattern up rostrally. There is innervation in parts of the striatum, or first I should say that one can follow the axons in the nigrostriatal pathway as well as in the medial foramen bundle here, along the pathway up to the striatum. And you can see part of the axons ramifying in the nucleus accumbens here, in the septum, in the anteromedial frontal cortex and the perirhinal cortex here. There is also innervation in the amygdala over here. And with an innervation pattern that is quite similar to what the normal innervation is. This is the comparison with the innervation we get from the ESL-derived neurons. These graphs tend to be larger in generally in volume. They contain a larger number of TH-positive cells also, but when we count the axons running in the nigrostriatal bundle, we see relatively similar numbers. And then you can see that we have a pattern that is reminiscent. There is an innervation of the dorsal striatum is a little more diffusely distributed. There is innervation of the accumbens, septum, the anteromedial frontal cortex, the perirhinal cortex, very much similar to the fetal ones. And when we do actual fiber counting using this technique that Bengt Mattsson has worked up, then we can, here you can see the comparison of fiber density from the fetal and the ESL derived. One can say that in some areas like the striatum, the fetal cells seem to be more efficient, denser innervation, whereas in some other areas like VTA innervated areas, particularly the infralimbic cortex, which is the part of the anteromedial frontal cortex, and also in septum, there tends to be higher innervations, suggesting perhaps that there might be a somewhat higher percentage of VTA-like A10 neurons in this mix. But that's been difficult to assess properly. So what we can conclude from this is that the cells that we can generate from the human ear cells with the floor plate protocol survive and show similar morphology and protein expression as fetal cells, and that both cell types are indeed generated. We can also show long-term recovery up to 6 months, which has been the longest we've studied so far. And with this equipotency test, we think we've also shown that they are just as efficient in inducing functional effect. And they are also similar in their outgrowth capacity. And given the distances that the axons grow from the nigra to the rostral forebrain, we think we can translate that to the human brain and say that the outgrowth capacity is quite sufficient to achieve a full reinnervation of the putamen, for example, in humans. So in the last part of my talk, I'll describe a series of experiments trying to identify the host inputs to GAFT neurons using this delta rabies monosynaptic tracing technique. This is a technique where one will transduce the transplanted cells with one vector. This is a lentiviral vector that is used in the generation of the cells, so that these cells will first be expressing GFP, thus being green, and secondly, they'll be expressing a rabies glycoprotein that's necessary for its spread from cell to cell. In this way, these cells can be transduced with a second vector, where the rabies glycoprotein is missing, but by combining it with the rabies protein, it can be transmitted across one synapse. The specificity of this system is building on the fact that this TVA receptor is being expressed, and the vector that is used to trace will only infect cells that express the TVA receptor. So this is what it will look like. And this is the tracing vector. The tracing vector is expressing MCHARI, which is red, and it will infect only TVA expressing cells, that's the grafted cells. So in the transplanted animals, we'll then inject a second lentiviral vector that will transduce the grafted cells with this MCHARI vector, and these cells will now express, be both yellow and red. Since these cells are expressing the glycoprotein, the rabies virus will be able to transmit to the next order connected cell, which will then be only red. The green will not be transferred. But since these cells are lacking the glycoprotein, the vector cannot continue any further. So it's across one synapse. And the concept is that the rabies vector is only transmitted across synaptic junctions. Whether or not that is absolutely 100% true, I'm not sure it's proven. But that's at least the basic concept, that this is a synaptic transfer. It's definitely a transfer along contacts. So this is what the transplants look like. These are then human ESL-derived cells injected. And with the lentivector, they become green fluorescent. Then the lentiviral vector is injected, and it will transduce the grafted cells, but only those cells that have the TVA receptor, so no cells outside the graft will be transduced. And here you see the co-localization of the red and the yellow. If we then look in the neighborhood of the graft, we'll now see host neurons that are only red. So cells in the striatum clearly project to the grafted neurons. And this is in the core of the transplant, where you can see that the efficiency of the lentivector to transduce the mCherry is quite high. We think that it's over 90% of the cells are actually being transduced. And if we then look further away, we find traced cells in the motor cortex. We found them in thalamus, and we found them down in substantia nigra. And this is now a plotting of cells where we find them. They are scattered cells, but it's well known that this technique is underestimating the actual contacts, because the efficiency by which the vector, the rabies vector, is transmitted is low. And when it's low, we will not be able to detect the mCherry, the red fluorescence. But as you see, we find it in prefrontal cortex, the cingulate cortex. We find them in thalamus. We find them in parts of amygdala down here. And you can see that already by 6 weeks, we can find trace neurons. And here is now by 6 months, when the numbers is somewhat increased, but it's basically the same structures. And we've counted the cells in different targets, and we can see that the most prominent target that projects to the grafted cells is in the prefrontal cortex, and then next is the sensory motor cortex and thalamus. And here are examples of morphologies of cells. By and large, when comparing this pattern with a pattern we get from injecting into normal striatum and looking in the literature, shows that it's essentially the same afferent inputs that are innervating striatum normally. So these grafts will be acquiring inputs from those afferents that otherwise are innervating primarily the striatal projection neurons. So the summary of these experiments is that the tracing constructs indeed are expressed long-term in the grafted cells. So one can, we did it over 6 months, but probably stays on. They are, the grafted neurons are innervated by all afferents that normally innervate the striatum. And the most prominent of these sources is the prefrontal cortex. So with this, I'm reach my conclusions, saying that now when we have got access to these so-called floor plate protocols, the production of authentic midbrain neurons have become very efficient. In Marlene Palmer's protocol, it's around 70 to 80% of all neurons that are expressing LMX FOXA2 with this protocol. And the protocol also advantages because they can be expanded in large numbers. Agnete, who's been doing this, has calculated that in our own laboratory settings, we could generate cells that estimated could be used in up to 500 patients. So without any modification of the current protocol, one can get sufficient cells for banking and storing and characterization of the cells. And that's one aspect that is important to achieve, because one has to certify and approve big batches of cells that would then be allowed to be used. And then once you need to produce a new batch, you have to certify and validate that one again. These cells, we think we can show survive and function long-term in the absence of any significant overgrowth or tumor formation, at least up to 6 months in the rodent experiments. And Lawrence Studer, together with Jeff Corder, are studying these kinds of cells in monkeys over longer survival times. But again, they need to do immunosuppression, which is really a challenge in monkeys in order to keep the cells alive for that long time. The functional potency and growth capacity of these cells seem to be very similar to fetal cells, which is another requirement to make them interesting to use clinically. And finally, it's interesting that they have this capacity to integrate into host circuitry. We think this is important in several ways. It may be important for maintaining their baseline functionality, but it means also that there can be some kind of integrated control function of the cells coming from the host brain. So with this, I want to point out that the key person to run this work is Malin Palmer, my former student and now colleague, and Shane Grealis, another student of mine who's been doing most of the in vivo work. And of course, the clinical pro team in Lund, led by Olle Lindvall and Håkan Widner, and Elisabeth Englund, who's been the neuropathologist helping us with the post-mortem analysis. So thank you.